Would you give a warm welcome to Pastor Eric Hutch?
Thanks, Dick. I got to make sure I'm all wired up. You got all the recording levels and everything going. All right, here we go. We'll just keep talking. Hutchie just keeps talking, talking, keep swimming, right? So I've got like a recorder in my back right pocket. I got my cell phone because I'm on call this weekend or for the next week in my left back pocket, and I got microphones on me. So I'm pretty wired up, you know. It's good breakfast, right? Did you guys have a good breakfast? How many of you ate breakfast? All right, now I'm concerned. Well, if you need breakfast, get some breakfast. It is a privilege to be here. When Dick originally invited me to come and speak, I was not sure what he was asking me to do. He asked if I would share a little bit of what I'm doing in the community, and I said, that'll take maybe about 10 minutes. And he said, great, I'll give you 50. I thought, okay, so we got to figure out how to fill this time, and I believe God has given me some insights on how I can encourage you and motivate you to kind of get in the game, you know, get involved and get active. Like Dick was saying earlier, I have the privilege of going into Skyview High School. The last 4 years, I spoke to over 1,500 high school students on the topic of abstinence. Really, I don't talk about abstinence. I talk about sex because they like it, and I like it. I know that sounds weird, but what I've discovered is if you speak truth to students, you win their favor, and they'll be more likely to listen to the ideas that you want to share with them. And so really what I talk to them about is relational health. What I've discovered, and it's interesting that Dick presented about, you know, talking more about sociology today, I have discovered as I meet with couples that they lack social intelligence. Social intelligence. Okay, now I'm not sure you know what I'm thinking, so let me share a little bit of what I'm thinking here. When I interact with couples and we just talk about the way that they relate with one another, they don't relate well with each other. And what I've discovered is maybe they haven't had good role models, maybe they come from broken families or whatever the case may be, their education, you name it, their lack of biblical understanding. They try to do marriage with very little social intelligence, and it doesn't work well. So a lot of my time, 60% of my time, I am face-to-face with husbands and wives working on social intelligence, how to treat one another, how to love one another according to the principles that God gives us in His Word. It is so much fun. I get charged up. This kind of thing that I'm doing today scares the living daylights out of me. I would much rather be in a small room with just you and your spouse, just going eyeball to eyeball, helping you guys to gain social intelligence. So it's really cool that I have some dear friends in the room because I'm going to look at you a lot today just so that you can comfort me. So you can just wink at me if I get a little freaked out or anything like that. That'll settle me down. That's right. Thank you, Chip. That's very good. That's going to help me. What I'd like to do is to kind of break this up into three parts. Number one, I want to talk to you about one of my Bible heroes, and I'll introduce you to him in just a moment, somebody who's given me some great inspiration to do the things that I'm doing today. I'm going to share a little bit next with you about my personal story, so that you kind of understand the man that's standing before you. I have one of those like really weird Hallmark stories. Like they literally could make a movie about my story and it would bring you to tears. And if I start to share too much, I will probably puddle on you. So I will not do that to you today. That could be a private conversation. And then lastly, I want to share with you some ideas about how to engage the community. I'm just crazy enough to get my foot out there in the water. That's all I am. I'm just crazy. My kids would tell you that. I have four boys at home, ages 21, 18, 16, and 12. I had to think about that one for a minute. Yeah, and they have literally caused me to lose some brain cells. So what I'd like to do now is I want to talk to you about a Bible hero of mine, and his name is Shamgar. How many of you know who Shamgar is? You ever heard of that name before? He's the third judge in a line of judges in the nation's era, the history of Israel. And Shamgar has a very interesting story. He's inspired me. And a book that I'd like to recommend to you is called this. This is a great read for high school students and junior high students. I'm preparing to take my boys through it. We have a little devotional on Monday night, so we're going to walk through this together. We do dinner, and then we do, I'll tell you the name of it in a minute. We do dinner, and then we do a little devotional, and then we get on the Xbox and play games. So it's kind of fun. Because it's boy time, you know what I'm saying? Boys need to shoot things, and I like to shoot things with them. All right, so this is called The Three Success Secrets of Shamgar. authored by Jay Strack and Pat Williams. Pat Williams is instrumental in launching the Orlando Magic. So a devout Christ follower has adopted, I think they've adopted a lot of kids, fostered many kids, and they have their own. So really cool stuff that Jay and Pat share. I'm going to share a few excerpts out of this book, but this is a great little read for you, telling the story of Shamgar through their eyes. A lot of conjecture, albeit there's little biblical evidence of what they share in here. However, there's a lot of principles that apply. And man, if that doesn't inspire you to get into the game, check your pulse, people. I mean, this is good stuff here. So I want to share just a little bit with you about one of my heroes called Shamgar. In the Bible, Moses is credited with about 136 chapters. 136 chapters written on the life of Moses. Joseph, 21 chapters. Jesus, he gets the first 89 chapters of the New Testament when you combine the Gospels. Shamgar, two verses. If you have a Bible, you're welcome to turn with me there. I'll read it to you. I don't even have my Bible. I got it on my phone, but I'm not going to use it there. This is found in Judges chapter 3, verse 31. Okay, this is like the bookend to that whole chapter. And here's what the Bible says. After Ehud, he was that left-handed judge that, you know, like sliced open. Yeah, it was gross. Anyway, boys love that story, I'm telling you. It's pretty cool. After Ehud came Shamgar, son of Anath, who struck down 600 Philistines with an ox goad. Oh, by the way, he too saved Israel. And then in Judges 5, verse 6, in the days of Shamgar, son of Anath, in the days of Jael, the roads were abandoned. Travelers took to winding paths. That's interesting to me. And again, to get a little deeper into his story, you'd have to get this book, and it's just fascinating. But what I found is Shamgar has been an incredible inspiration for me. First, you must understand what was going on at that time. There was no king. There was no leadership. This is between the time of the kings and Joshua and Caleb. So a little bit of chaos is going on here. They didn't eradicate all of the pagan people. So invaders were constantly warring against the nation of Israel. And so judges would rise up. They weren't elected leaders. They would just kind of come out of nowhere and then lead troops and have battles and save the people of Israel. Second, understand that it was a dangerous time. In fact, it was so dangerous that people got off the beaten path and took to winding paths. They got out of the public square. They got into the shadows because their lives depended on that. They couldn't be out in public. Otherwise, the Philistines would come in and just destroy them. So they got off the beaten path and they took to the shadows. Third, Shamgar was likely a farmer. Anyone know what an ox goad is? All it is a spear, you know, a stick with a little point at the end and maybe a flattened edge. Could have been bronze, or it could have been tipped with bronze. And basically, a farmer would use that as the ox are pulling the plow. He'd kind of poke them in that hide to get them moving, right? And then that blade end, that would be used to kind of knock off the clay that would build up on the plowshare, right? So he's likely a farmer. The other thing you have to understand, too, is that he killed 600 Philistines single-handedly. Oh, my goodness. Oh, by the way, he, too, saved Israel. One man. One man. And the principle I'd like to share with you today, the first one is this, that it's the power of one. How one person can impact the world around us. Just one. Now, the odds seem overwhelming, right? 600 to 1. So here's just a few concepts I want to leave with you today about Shamgar. It's very simple. You can write this down. Start where you are. Use what you have. Do what you can. Start where you are. Use what you have. Do what you can. The power of one. I'd like to read you a short story out of this book. On February 7, 1996, Randall White, Kevin Farr, Brian Hernandez, all 18, spent the evening bowling just outside of Tampa, Florida. A little before midnight, they got into their Chevy Camaro and went for a drive east of town. As they drove through the intersection of Lithia, Pinecrest, and Keysville Roads, their car was broadsided by an 8-ton truck. All three were killed instantly. These young men had not been drinking or speeding. They had not been negligent in any other way. Why did the accident happen? Because someone had uprooted the stop sign that normally guarded the intersection. Three young pranksters, all about the same age as the young men who died, had gone around Tampa taking down stop signs just to see what would happen. The perpetrators, two boys and a girl, were convicted, though a state appeals court later tossed out their convictions because of errors. Imagine what would happen if all the stop signs and traffic lights in our society were suddenly removed one night. What kind of chaos would result? How many people would die? Who would want to live in a world without stop signs? Friends, yet that is the society that Shamgar was living in. It was a civilization without stop signs, without order, without justice. Twice in the book of Judges, Judges 17:6 and 21:25, we read this bleak description of the days in which Shamgar lived. In those days, there was no king in Israel, but every man did that which was right in his own eyes. There was no king, no law, no justice, no standard of right and wrong. Does that sound familiar? And yet in some ways, here we are, 3,000 years later, and it can still be said that people do what is right in their own eyes. We live in a postmodern world, a world in which the old rules have been torn down and the old values have been uprooted. So our world needs men and women like Shamgar, people who are willing to step into the moral vacuum and do what is right and righteous. The history of Israel, as recorded in the Old Testament, is a history of a nation that sank into moral and spiritual chaos, accompanied by social breakdown and desolation. Could America be headed for the same destination? Now, friends, I don't know. I don't know the answer to that question. But I do know that these are times that people cry out to take a stand for where they are, to use what they have and do what they can, just like Shamgar. Proverbs 14:12 says what? There is a way that seems right to a man, but in the end it leads to death, destruction. So we live in a culture where everybody follows a way that seems right, a culture that there are no stop signs. And that leads to death because it leads away from God. Shamgar, this little known judge in the book of Judges, 2 verses to his name, and yet he slays 600 Philistines and he does what? Oh, by the way, he too saved Israel. The power of one. 2 Timothy 4:2 says this, be prepared. Be prepared. In season and out of season. What are we doing to prepare ourselves to impact this culture around us? What are we doing? Well, that leads to the second point. What is your ox goad? Right? What's your ox goad? What is the implement that is in your hands that you can use to start making a difference? Remember, Shamgar is a man of the soil, not the sword. There was no organized army. He didn't have any military training. And yet, he was a farmer. I like farmers. How about that Super Bowl commercial? Did that bring a tear to your eye? If not, let me slap you, because that was a good commercial, right? He was a man of the soil, not the sword. Yet he couldn't take it anymore. He had to do something. I don't know what that scene must have looked like, but let's just throw a little conjecture into this. He's out there plowing his fields, and he noticed this band of people rushing into the nearby lands. Maybe a neighbor. Maybe somebody he cared deeply about. Philistines were pretty ruthless people. They were ruthless. Perhaps they ravaged the neighbor's land, set it afire, killed the inhabitants, killed dear friends of his. Can you see this man huddled in his home going, God, what can I do? The people around me are dying. I got to do something. Maybe he called in some friends and said, what should we do? Maybe they looked at him and said, Sham, I don't know, dude. Sham, wow, I don't know. Right? What do you think we should do, Sham? I think we get up and we go after him. But good luck with that. Good luck with that. Shamgar probably was a hunter, I would suspect, you know, living off the land a little bit, you know, probably his fields, but also he's got to have some meat, right? Boys got to have meat. I know this firsthand. Boys need meat. I suspect that he was not only a great farmer, but he was likely a great hunter. Now, it doesn't say he used a bow and arrow. He used a what? An ox goad. Remember, conjecture here. I'm reading into the story a little bit. Give me some liberty here. It's morning, so I can do that. Maybe he took that stick, that implement, and he developed a prowess for hunting. Stealthy hunting. Imagine that. Maybe he hung out in the woods as Philistines would march on by, and he would attack them without them even knowing it. Hey, where's Joe? I don't know. Is he going to the bathroom? Have no idea. Where'd he go? Right? I mean, this is the kind of stuff that kind of fills my mind. I know it's a little crazy getting inside this thing, but it is. That's the kind of stuff that inspires me. What are our resources, friends? What is it that's in our hand? Well, first you have your dreams. And I just simply leave you with this quote about dreams. Ask not for dreams equal to your abilities. Ask for abilities equal to your dreams. Ask not for dreams equal to your abilities, but ask for abilities equal to your dreams. Because if it's the former, then why need God, right? But if it's the latter, oh dear, Lord, help me. Help me. You have another resource. You have your enthusiasm. Oh, I got to read you this story because it comes from one of my favorite football teams, the Pittsburgh Steelers. It is the favorite football team here, friends. And if you don't like it, tough. Okay. Andy Russell was a legendary Steeler linebacker, the gap-toothed, roaring leader of Steelers' steel curtain defense. Russell once recalled how he learned the true depth of enthusiasm from defensive tackle Ernie Stotner. You're going to love this story. Ernie comes into the huddle and his thumb is broken back against his wrist. There's a tear near the break and his bone's sticking out. He has a compound fracture of the thumb. He takes his thumb in his hand and he wrenches it down into his fist. Doesn't show anybody, doesn't say anything, looks up and says, "What's the defense?" Are you liking it so far? I thought to myself, I'm not in the right business. So he stayed there for the rest of that series, and then when we came off the field, I'm watching him because I'm the only guy who saw that he had a compound fracture. I saw the bone. So I'm figuring now he's going to ask for a doctor, and he may have to go to the hospital because this thing could get infected. But he says, "Give me some tape." I love it. So they throw him some tape, and he just starts taping this huge ball. He makes this big fist. Then we go back in. He plays the entire game, never misses a down. I'm just astounded, and he's using his hand, which is broken, as a club. He's beating people with it. After the game, we go into the locker room, and he says, "Hey, Doc, I think I got a problem." And I'm thinking, this is just unbelievable. That is passion for what you do. That guy was making no money. He just loved to play. You got your enthusiasm. Another resource you have is your talent. Now, you're probably wondering, talent? Well, every one of us has been given some talent, some a little bit more than others. But you have your talent. So, I'm thinking, Shamgar, you know, talent. He's a farmer. He's gotten pretty good at using an ox goad, taking down a few deer now and again. So he uses his talent. to save a nation. Maybe you have your education. We don't know Shamgar's education. But what we do know is he probably sat around the campfire listening to the stories of how God delivered his nation, his ancestors. I love campfire stories. In fact, friends, I get to sit around the campfire every week. I call it this. When I meet with couples, they sit in my chairs and we have conversations. And when we conclude, I generally say something like this. I want to just say thank you for the privilege of sitting at your campfire, roasting marshmallows and hearing your story. Friends, do you know the sacredness of that? Honestly, do you understand how sacred it is to be invited into somebody's story and hear the things that they've had to endure and walk through? I don't care how good they have it or how crazy they have it. That, my friends, is sacred ground. I love it. It gives me goosebumps thinking about it because I also get to watch miracles happen. Oh my goodness. It is amazing. Shamgar, his education may have just come by sitting around the campfire, learning about some of the military ways. Who knows? But he used what he had in that moment. Maybe you have your experience, again, Shamgar and throwing that spear. Oh my goodness. I could just imagine what the Philistines were thinking. They're sitting around their own campfires, right? They're taking off their armor and their swords are on the side and their helmets. Dude, did you hear last night? That whole troop down there, they just got knocked out by the phantom. Have no idea who this guy is. All we see is these big holes in their chest. Are you kidding me? How cool is that? I love it. Next night, they're sitting around the campfire. How many are here? Well, we're down to four. We had 12. The phantom. You have your influence. One of the greatest people that I'm still learning to understand how to influence others. The greatest model of influence is Jesus himself. Man, have you ever read through the Gospels and just were astounded by how he influenced people? That is amazing to me. I'm still learning how to do that. A word that I've been camping on for many months right now is found in 2 Corinthians chapter 5. And it talks about persuade people. How we persuade others to understand reconciliation, that we are ambassadors of reconciliation, teaching them about the reconciliation that's available to them through Jesus Christ and how we persuade them. It's an art form. It's something that I'm still learning how to perfect. And one of the greatest examples of influence and persuasion is Jesus himself. The gentleness that he engages with people. Friends, we need to learn how to do that. I call that social intelligence. We must learn how to engage people lovingly, kindly, gently. And lastly, your wisdom. And what I love in the scriptures, again, found in James chapter 1, verse 5. If any of you lacks wisdom, he should what? Ask. Oh my goodness, are you kidding me? That's all I need to do? Just ask. And what does God do? How does he respond? He gives a little bit. Generously to all. What I love, he doesn't find any fault. Just, here you go. Ask. When I meet with couples again, I say, who's been helping you? I don't know. Oh, I'm so glad you're here. Can I turn you to the source of wisdom that has helped guide me? It's amazing. Absolutely amazing. What is your ox goad? What is the implement in your hand? Shamgar, start where you are. Use what you have. And lastly, do what you can. Do what you can. I got to read this one too because this is pretty cool. This comes right out of the military manual. The U.S. Army Training Manual, FC 100-20, May 1986, says that low-intensity conflict is generally confined to a specific geographic area and is often characterized by limitations of armaments, tactics, and level of force. It's quite likely that Shamgar was engaged in what we call guerrilla warfare, an insurgency. How about that? An ox goad certainly qualifies as a limited armament, a weapon. One man alone taking on an army of 600 certainly qualifies as a limitation of tactics and level of force. So Shamgar was a guerrilla fighter. And guerrilla fighters never get the glory that five-star generals do. How many verses? And what did he do? Oh, by the way, he too saved Israel. What can one person do? Oh, my friends, one person can impact a community, can impact a nation. By the way, he too saved Israel. Thing about Shamgar's name, it's somewhat of a derivative of Samuel. No one's really quite sure, but what I find interesting is it's a name that denotes someone who listens to the Lord. Someone who listens to the Lord. Are you listening to God? But not only listening, as in Shamgar's name, but also following, obedience. Start where you are. Use what you have. Do what you can. Let me tell you a little bit about my story. How are we doing on time, Dick? Do you even know? I'll look for you. It's 1:45. So I got 15 minutes, but you took 5, so I'm going to take another 5. Is that okay? Perfect. So much fun. Oh, this is making me so nervous. Okay. Friends, I did not grow up in the church. In fact, I was born in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I was born as an illegitimate child. My mom had an affair. It was a one-night stand. Bam, here I am. She had 3 children ahead of her. The story that was told to me as I was growing up was that my mom was a school teacher, and in order for her marriage to reconcile, she had to give away the child. I was born in 1967, so I'm 45 years old, going on 46. My mother was married to a military man. He was fighting in Vietnam, was deployed, I want to say, in the summer of 1966. In December of that year, during the holiday season, because the way that the families were kind of bonding during conflict, it was not uncommon for people to kind of rally together, families to get together. And a bachelor was part of that group that my biological mother was involved with. And they went out to dinner one night because he was being deployed very shortly thereafter. And he stayed a little longer than he should. How you doing? Damn, here I am. Oh, you can't do that. This is recording everything I say, including the comments that I was saying prior to getting up here. So that needs to be trimmed out, right, Thomas? Thank you very much. Is that going to work? Okay, buddy. So my mother, knowing that in order for her marriage to reconcile and to keep things intact, she knew that she had to give me up for adoption. She birthed me in secret, basically. I don't know how she hid it from her other 3 children. But my parents, my mom and dad, who are my adoptive parents, they received me the day after I was born. So I was removed from my birth mother's care, and the next day I was placed in the hands of my mom and dad. Mom and dad grew up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. They did not want to raise a child in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, so they decided to move west, threw a dart at the map, and hit Helena. Isn't that crazy? So I grew up in Helena, Montana. We moved there in 1969. I was 18 months old. I went to school there, but unfortunately I didn't grow up in the church. Mom and dad... My dad has Christian Orthodox roots. Anybody from the Christian Orthodox Church here? You're from the Christian Orthodox? Do you attend here in Billings? Okay. So there, you probably understand that there's not a lot of diversity in Montana. And back in the late 60s, early 70s, I'm not certain that there was an Orthodox church available for worship. So dad didn't have a place to go. And then mom, she grew up in the Catholic Church. It's interesting that Grandma Massimini... Nice Italian name, right? Grandma Massimini used to be a nun, and so obviously that didn't work out. Isn't this fun? All I'm doing is inviting you to roast marshmallows in my campfire. That's all we're doing here today. At any rate, moved to Montana in 1969, landed in Helena, went to school, grew up, but didn't grow up in the church. It was really foreign to me. In fact, I can recall driving around Helena, Montana, looking at all these amazing buildings and wondering in my mind, as a little kid, wow, there must be a lot of people who love God. And they must all get along. Right. So I had an identity crisis when I was in junior high, because when I really started to learn about my adoption, one person said a comment that spun my world into orbit. They said something like this. I grew up in the bowling alley, so you can imagine that the bowling atmosphere is not the greatest atmosphere to grow up in, at any rate. I wanted to be a pro bowler. I'm a scratch bowler, so if you want to go out and roll some lines, I'll take you out. Okay? We'll have some fun. At any rate, a young man said to me, who are your parents? And I said, well, Mom and Dad are right over there. And he says, no kidding. You don't look anything like them. That haunted me for years. Junior high. So you can imagine a young man who has no identity in Christ starts to look for an identity in the world. Led me down a bad path. Man's ways are not God's ways, and those ways tend to lead to destruction. So I was on a path of destruction. Got into alcohol, drinking. My senior year of high school, I got into smoking marijuana. The summer before my senior year of high school, I met a young gal on a blind date. My best friend thought it'd be fun to set me up on a blind date. And she was a very cute gal. She was a church-going gal. In fact, she grew up in the Assembly of God Church in Helena there. And she kind of, so cute. It's kind of like those trophy girls in high school. You want one of those really cute little girls on your arm? Because look at me, I'm a nerdy guy. I mean, back then it was even worse. I'm not kidding you. It was bad news. Dude, I'm not kidding. So I had this trophy girl. And in fact, I had to even go up to the other high school to get a girlfriend because nobody would date me at my own. It's just bad news. I know it. Gosh, Eric, grow up. So I chased her into the church. You know, we went to those youth group things and in an Assembly of God, things are pretty hopping, you know. It's very foreign to me. I did have a couple of Catholic services. That was weird to me, too. So it was very, very different. But I stuck with it. The summer of after I graduated high school, my girlfriend goes to Bible camp. She comes back from Bible camp, a renewed gal. You know, kind of like those rededication experiences that you've probably experienced as well. And she sits me down and she looks me in the eyeball and she says, I can't do this anymore. What are you talking about? She says, I can't keep going out with you anymore. Fearing of what was inevitable, she said, it's either my way or the highway. Get right or get left. Turn or burn. Right? Are you with me so far? So we broke up. Just a few weeks prior to my enrollment at Montana State University, Bozeman, go Cats. I have the microphone. A few days after she broke up with me, I decided to get down on my hands and knees and confess my need for a Savior and surrender my life to Christ. That was in September of 1985. Well, as a young believer and going to a very secular school, you can imagine the challenges doing that. I got to break out all these habits and whatnot. And, you know, it was a struggle. It was a challenge. And by the way, I did call my girlfriend back and say, hey, by the way, guess what happened to me? So cool. You're going to love it. I became a Christian. Oh, thrill. That was her response, not mine. She's like, what does that mean? I'm like, well, that's confusing to me. Because if angels are rejoicing because I just gave my life to the Lord, how come you're not? It's like, because I don't know what that means. I mean, I got to think about this. Well, we ended up renewing our relationship, and we dated throughout college. We married in July of 1989, and we now have a family of four boys. So we've been together 29 years come this July, married for 23. Is that the right math? I don't know. Who cares? Amazing woman. And if it weren't for her standing up for her convictions, kind of like that Shamgar experience, it's very likely I wouldn't have this conversation with you today. Very likely. I'd have probably been on TV doing a lot of bowling and in a bad place. In a really bad place. About 5 years after we were married, and it was 5 years. In 1994, we were invited by Norm Christofferson to plant a new church in Helena, Montana, called Neighborhood Assembly of God. He invited us to come and do the youth ministry there. So we helped launch the youth ministry. In fact, our former secretary is sitting over there. Linda, give a little wave. Atta girl. So she moved to Billings before I got here because she needed to do this marriage thing. It's kind of cool. Good job, Earl. Married a good gal. At any rate, we joined the staff of Neighborhood Assembly of God in 1996. I left a job at Blue Cross and Blue Shield. I was eventually a manager at Blue Cross and Blue Shield. my career track was I wanted to be the CEO of Blue Cross and Blue Shield and Reform Healthcare in Montana. That was my goal. But God had a different plan. He got me into the ministry track, and I knew that I was called to ministry even before I was a Christian. I knew I was going to be in ministry. So it wasn't a question of if, it was a question of when. And when the invitation came, it was easy for me to look at my director in the eye and say, Jim, I'm out of here. Dude, see you later. He's going, Hutch, you are crazy, boy. And I go, I know it. It doesn't make any sense, does it? But this is what God has called me to do. So we did youth ministry for about 8 or 9 years. And then eventually I became more and more frustrated with youth ministry because I saw kids come into the youth ministry and go out of the youth ministry and very few were changing. And so I began asking the question, what in the world is going on there? And the Lord was helping me to understand, well, you got 4 boys. Who's taking care of them? I go, oh, that's right. Parents should take care of their kids, right? So I better take care of my own youth group. That's a big deal. So I started investing more in my kids and then started investing more in parents. And then as I got more involved with the parents, God's saying to me, you know, if you want to help parents, you need to help the marriage. Holy cow, where did I miss that? So I started working on my marriage, which in turn helped me to work with other people's marriages. Because I really had no credibility yet. I hadn't experienced half the things that many of you have experienced. And I'm still growing to learn this thing. And then God moves us to Harvest Church in 2007. First to be the small group pastors, but then after a year I asked Pastor Vern, I said, you know, Vern, do you mind if Sherry and I start a marriage mentor ministry here at the church and train up couples to work with other couples? Because I'm just seeing a lot of people that are hurting. He's like, Hutch, you have my blessing, go do it. So I'm like, sweet. So I've been doing that for the last 4 years, and it's been an amazing ride. I love what I do. I love getting in the grill of people. I love roasting marshmallows at their campfire. I love it, love it, love it. It recharges me. It refreshes me. I go home at night and I give to my wife and then I sleep really well. It is so much fun. Some of you are going, that dude is crazy. I must be. I'm more concerned about where people's hearts are to help them to get to where God wants them to be. And the best way that I can do that with my ox goat is to go one-on-one. So Sherry and I mentor a few couples and then I do a lot of counseling in my office. So really, what now? I mean, Eric, that's great about your story, but what about me? What do I do? What's my Shamgar calling? Well, let me just encourage you with this. Get your house in order. Get your house in order. As I hear story after story of people who have not had godly examples of what life or what God's plan is for life and marriage, my heart just breaks for them. Because they've got a long hill to climb. And if we, the church, and especially in pastoral ministry, if we get our house in order, I will tell you this. This is what I've learned and experienced. You teach what you know, you reproduce who you are. You teach what you know, which I don't know a lot of stuff, guys. I really don't. But my goal is to live a righteous and godly life. And that is going to reproduce. Are you with me? That's a great place for an amen, right? Yeah, we'll turn you into Pentecostal before we leave, okay? Right? Get your house in order. And if you don't know how to do that, would you call somebody, please? Get wisdom. Call a friend. Call me. Call someone who can get you on that path. Andy Stanley preaches a sermon. I love it. It's called The Principle of the Path. He says this, direction, not intention, determines your destination. Should I say it again? Direction, not intention, determines your destination. And there's a whole lot of people on the wrong path with great intentions. They're going to have a bad outcome. Direction, not intention, determines your destination. If you're on a path that's leading you to a bad place, you might need some help getting off that path. I don't care how much you pray, how much you go to church, how much you tithe. It doesn't matter, because if you're on the wrong path, you're going to have a bad outcome. Get some help. Get your house in order. Secondly, motivate your pastor. Encourage your pastor to get involved with some things that are happening around the country. One of the things that I'm doing right now is trying to motivate pastors in the Billings community to consider getting involved with a thing called a community marriage policy. It's an agreement, kind of a handshake agreement, that as pastors and spiritual leaders in our community, we are going to commit to helping couples prepare for marriage through using an assessment or premarital counseling, but doing something. Couples' success of marriage increases if they seek any form of premarital training. No kidding. And some pastors may not have the resources to get that accomplished. Well, friend, I'm telling you what. I'm not the senior pastor at Harvest Church. I'm not the lead guy. I'm the marriage and family pastor. I get time to do this kind of stuff. I don't need to preach sermons every weekend. This is straining for me. This is out of my rhythm. So I have the time to get out into the streets and knock on doors and meet with pastors. And I love it. So rallying them together. And what I need you to do is to encourage your pastor to get involved, because, you know, he may not have met with me, he or she, and they're going, I don't know who this guy is. Maybe he's a sheep shifter. And I don't want my sheep going up to their pen. I'm not a sheep shifter. I'm going, holy smokes, people, there are so many folks in our communities that are not attending church. And we can engage them meaningfully if we get more involved. So encourage your pastor to contact me. And I've got a little flyer here, and I'll leave it. It's a pastor's rally we're going to do in just a few weeks. I'm bringing Mike McManus, who is kind of the brainchild of the community marriage policy. He's helped over 200 communities in our nation sign community marriage policies. In communities where these are successful and really active, they've watched divorce rates decline anywhere between 30 and 50%. Holy smokes! We've got to do something. In those communities where they see those divorce rates decline, they also begin to see social intelligence increase. The health of the community begins to thrive. Isn't that amazing? And the tax savings? Holy smokes. Tom Wright? Tom has gathered a study together. What's it called? Taxpayers? Do you remember? Taxpayer costs for unwed and... Correct. And I'm putting Tom on the spot for a moment. He's a former representative for state legislature, so majority leader in the House. Is that correct? So Tom was instrumental at trying to motivate folks to consider. We're bringing Mike out in a few weeks. We're going up to the state legislature and having some meetings with some legislators to help them consider ideas of policies that we can encourage the leaders to consider that can help motivate people towards marriage health and wellness. If we spend in Montana alone $113 million on single parenting and unwed childbearing, all the support system, $113 million. Okay, now you got me going. If we could save, think of this, in Yellowstone County, if we could save 10% of those costs, because we kind of represent 10% of the population of Montana, right? Are you with me? So $113 million is how much? $11.3 million. I know this because I went to MSU to become an accountant. That's why I'm a pastor today. It's true. So $11.3 million just in Yellowstone County. I'm saying this. If that's our share of Montana's cost here in Yellowstone County, what if we could just avert 10% of divorces? $1.13 million. Are you with me? Wouldn't it be cool if we get our house in order as the church and we start modeling this? And increasing the health of our community, that we can be a model community for other communities in Montana. And not only that, I could do quite a bit with $1.13 million. I mean, my dream is this. It would be great to have a marriage and family fitness center here in Billings, Montana. Now, I'm not talking about where you're pumping weights, but where people can come and understand and increase their social intelligence. Hello. Amen. Thank you for that. Right? So we get our house in order. We motivate our pastors to get involved. We encourage our policymakers. I have some ideas about how we can do that. Wouldn't it be great if we have these marriage mentors that are trained up and meet with couples who are preparing for marriage? And then when people go down to the county courthouse to sign and get their marriage license, they go, oh, by the way, have you taken any kind of premarital preparation? Great, now your marriage fee is discounted. Wouldn't it be great? So I'm saying, let's not change the license fee. Let's just increase it for those who haven't done any premarital preparation. Are you with me on this? And lastly, we got to engage the schools. This abstinence stuff has been absolutely fun for me. I love talking to kids about sex. It is fun. They're doing it. They're having it. So let's help them understand right? What the best context to enjoy this experience is in. And when I sit with a group of students, and about 30 to 60 students each presentation, I'll do 11 presentations in 2 days. I am talked out. I've discovered that I could do a little survey at the end. There's at least 90 to 95% approval of the information that they're receiving. You guys, they need to know this stuff. And they need to understand relational intelligence. So there are things that we can do. Those are my aux codes. There are things that you can do to get involved in the community and begin to impact marriages. You're probably going, yeah, but we've been married 60 years and I don't know if I can impact anybody. I don't even know how to talk to this generation. Friend, you've got things to share with the younger generation. Grab a next door neighbor with those little ones running around. Go and babysit for them and say, you need a date night. Go out and build some relationship with your partner. Hey, you want to come over for dinner? Let us tell you the secret. I just did a funeral yesterday. Okay, funeral yesterday for a friend. And I bumped into a gal there who was a cousin of the deceased. And I said, how long have you guys been married? She said, well, we've been married. It'll be 50 years this year. Holy smokes, that's awesome. I high-fived her, right? Because we don't hear much of that anymore, right? And I always love talking to people at weddings and funerals when there's like an enduring marriage like that. I lean over and I go, what's your secret? Oh, it's so much fun. You get different answers. You know what hers was? Compromise. You know where my brain went immediately? Philippians 2, 3, and 4. Do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit, but in humility consider others better than yourselves. Each of you should look not only to your own interests, but also to the interests of others. Doesn't that sound a lot like compromise to you? Like meeting somewhere in the middle. And I high-fived her again. I said, honey, you got my badge. That's what we can do. Shamgar, the power of one. You start where you are, you use what you have, and you do what you can. And I just got a text, so I need to go. Thank you very much. Dick, come, and I'll let you take us next.